Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, in a move that seemed to surprise everyone, the Washington Post was sold to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. In an era of billionaire media moguls, what could this mean? We'll ask veteran reporter David K. Johnston. Also on Counterspin today, 1 year ago, a white supremacist killed six and injured many more at a Sikh temple or gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. The atrocity and its one-year commemoration haven't got the attention that some other massacres have received, but a lot is going on in Oak Creek. We'll talk to the Real News Network's Jocelyn Knorr about the one-year anniversary of the massacre at Oak Creek. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's news.
In response to the terror chatter that has the United States closing embassies around the world, the TV networks have given a platform to U.S. officials who are using this story to bolster the beleaguered National Security Agency. Across the Sunday chat shows on August 4th, lawmakers lined up to send the very same message. Sure, we've seen all of this controversy over NSA surveillance, but this is the kind of surveillance that stops terrorists. Meet the Press told viewers they'd get a debate, but what they got was far-right Rick Santorum and MSNBC liberal Joy Ann Reid basically agreeing with each other. Meet the Press did have one critic of government surveillance. They played a tape of Senator Frank Church appearing on the show in 1975. Now, if this is all for real, is the assumption that NSA snooping led the government to uncover this plot well-founded? Well, the Associated Press reported that one government official doesn't think so. Quote, an intelligence official said the controversial NSA programs that gather data on American phone calls or track internet communications with suspected terrorists played no part in detecting the initial tip. Close quote. Nonetheless, we have people speaking openly about supposed al-Qaeda chatter, and then we see a Daily Beast report claiming that the intelligence about this pending attack came from the government listening in on an al-Qaeda conference call. Clearly, there are people in government who are talking, and in some cases spilling the beans on what seems like some rather sensitive matters. But these are the kinds of government leaks the government doesn't object to.
Edward Snowden's temporary asylum in Russia has prompted outrage. Defiant Russia grants Snowden years asylum, was the New York Times headline. The Washington Post reported that Russia had opened a fresh wound, and USA Today's cover headline read, Welcome, Comrade Snowden. But there was little context concerning how countries approach asylum or why some nations refuse to extradite those wanted on serious charges. And very little on cases where the U.S. has protected suspected criminals, even mass murderers. As Dan Beaton wrote on the CIPR blog, the U.S. has long refused to extradite Bolivia's former president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, whose order for the Bolivian military to fire on protesters in 2003 left 67 dead. And for years, the U.S. has sheltered anti-Castro terrorist Luis Posada Carriles, who blew up a civilian Cuban airliner in 1976, killing 73. The New York Times mentioned some of this history at the bottom of the July 12th piece, saying that Washington's push for extradition has poked at a sore spot for several countries that have sought the extradition of people wanted by their justice systems. The Times mentioned Carriles and noted that Ecuador can't get the U.S. to turn over two bankers who were, quote, at the center of a huge Ecuadorian financial scandal in the 1990s, close quote. The worst allegations that pundits have leveled at Snowden are that his leaks could endanger Americans, allegations for which there's no evidence. We'd be having a more interesting and honest discussion about Snowden's asylum if journalists could try to see this issue from the perspective of those outside the United States.
You know that bumper sticker that wonders what life would be like if the military had to hold bake sales instead of public schools? Well, based on some recent coverage, you'd think the military was heading down that road thanks to big budget cuts, cuts that are made to sound big when media outlets don't provide the right context to readers. There are two rounds of budget cuts here, normal spending reductions and the cuts from the across-the-board automatic sequester. If both things happen, according to the Washington Post, quote, the Pentagon would have to trim $50 billion from its budget during 2014 and $500 billion over the next decade, close quote. The New York Times gave readers a range. Maybe it's $150 billion over 10 years. Maybe it's $500 billion. Cuts in troops, civilians looming, read a USA Today headline over a story that was basically an interview with Deputy Defense Secretary Ashton Carter. He was also on the PBS NewsHour that same night to talk about the dangers of slashing the budget. These are all big numbers that are being thrown around, but how big is the Pentagon's budget? Economist Dean Baker notes that over the 10 years that we're talking about, the Pentagon would spend about $8 trillion, meaning we could be talking about budget cuts of around 6%. Now, that number doesn't sound nearly as ominous. And how do these decimated military budgets compare to previous military budgets? These articles don't say, which is probably the way the Pentagon wants it. But the dangerously lean military budgets they're talking about would be equivalent to what the Pentagon was spending in the mid-2000s. Context like that would make the Pentagon's complaining sound a little silly.
Veteran journalist Ted Koppel writes in a Wall Street Journal op-ed that the U.S. must stop overreacting to terror threats. Terrorism is designed to produce overreaction, he explains. And it seems to be working, with many American embassies and diplomatic outposts currently closed over a perceived terror threat. Koppel adds, quote, we have created an economy of fear, an industry of fear, a national psychology of fear. Al-Qaeda could never have achieved that on its own, close quote. Sure, Koppel writes, terrorists with weapons of mass destruction are frightening, quote, but nothing would give our terrorist enemies greater satisfaction than that we focus obsessively on that remote possibility and restrict our lives and liberties accordingly, close quote. Hard to argue with that, but it reminded us of an op-ed in the New York Times in 2006 that said if the U.S. were to ease sanctions on Iran, it should send this message, quote, if a dirty bomb explodes in Milwaukee or some other nuclear device detonates in Baltimore or Wichita, if Israel or Egypt or Saudi Arabia should fall victim to a nuclear accident, Iran should understand that the United States government will not search Iran for the perpetrator. The return address will be predetermined, and it will be somewhere in Iran, close quote. So the response to any act of terrorism against the United States should be an attack on Iran? That op-ed was written by the same Ted Koppel who now warns about overreaction. Either his analysis is evolving or he believes that massive unprovoked military attacks on another country are not terrorism.
And finally, Anthony Weiner is running well behind the other contenders in the New York mayoral primary. But as you've probably heard, Weiner's involved in yet another lewd scandal. And that means national journalists are covering his campaign. And all the while, they're wondering why they're doing so. Take ABC's This Week, which devoted an unusual amount of airtime to the Weiner scandal on August 4th. It kicked off with host Martha Raddatz wondering why they were even paying him so much attention. Pundit George Will made his point clear, Weiner will not win. He's never been much of a politician, so let's not waste our time. ABC reporter Jeff Zeleny agreed, we are not going to be talking about Anthony Weiner for that much longer, he told viewers. So I guess that's that, but then no, it's not. Raddatz kept at it. Well, what about Weiner's wife? One panelist, former CNN host Soledad O'Brien, made the obvious point that maybe we should be talking about actual issues that matter to people. Raddatz heard that, presumably, but then she posed the next question. How does this scandal affect the Clintons? And how does it impact Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign? Now, it's bad enough that media are giving this story much attention at all. But it's even more obnoxious when they tell you they're talking about something they know doesn't really matter. They acknowledge that they're spending time on this instead of spending time on actual issues, and then they play the why are we even paying any attention to this game.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Media love to write about the media business, it's true, but the sale of the Washington Post to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos is a big deal whether or not you follow the business of journalism closely at all. Reactions have run the gamut from, I can't believe the guy who's killing print is buying a newspaper, to a hands-off billionaire with no obvious political agenda is the best kind of billionaire. Joining us now to sort through some of this is veteran journalist David K. Johnston. David, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Part of your take is somewhat optimistic if we're headed into this new age where savvy billionaires are the only ones who want to buy papers or who can buy papers. We could do worse than someone like Jeff Bezos. He's competitive, he's willing to absorb the losses, and he'll experiment. The other argument, of course, is what does someone like Jeff Bezos want with the Washington Post? He's got business before the government, contract with the CIA. Can it be both of those things at the same time, I guess?
Well, if he starts blatantly using the newspaper to advance his regulatory interests, competitors in those businesses will be all over him. He'll lose any credibility in that area. You could do that more back long before the Internet. I remember Hearst and Pulitzer ginned up war to sell newspapers. But we live in a much more sophisticated world now. I think the optimistic view here is that the 400-year-old model of newspapers, which began as a way for the mercantile classes, the manufacturers and the traders and the rest of the bourgeoisie, to gain information and acquire information which would give them some power against the predatory instincts of the aristocratic class, and which prospered in an industrialized world because of classified advertising. That's where the money is. Pulitzer called it mustard. If you bought a full-page ad in the New York Times at the rate they charge for classified ads, you'd be buying the equivalent of like 5 or 10 pages. But that's all gone away. It's gone to the Internet. And so someone like Bezos represents the possibility that a actually working economic model will emerge. And whereas now, well, they'll deny it. The fact is the New York Times struggles to make sure they have enough money in the till every week to pay the payroll.
Part of this argument is that this is somebody who's going to innovate. It's guessing at this point about what he's going to do, but there was this story in the Washington Post that caught my eye offering a few ideas. The homepage of the Washington Post could be personalized for each user. They'll be tracking the things you're most likely to read if they're using Amazon-style technology. Advertising could be tailored to each individual based on what you're reading or what you're buying from Amazon. These are interesting kind of business concepts, but they could certainly conflict with the more traditional ideas in journalism about how the news is what's important, and we shouldn't mix that up too much with commerce.
Well, and I absolutely think that you're going to see dramatic changes in the way electronic news is done with Bezos and tracking customers, customizing the paper you see are things that are highly likely to occur. What's changed is, you know, it used to be you could publish a great newspaper in Watsonville, California and win a Pulitzer Prize, but your influence ended at the last doorstep you had home delivery of the paper. With the Internet, all of this now has changed. And if you can get scale, you can have a lot of influence. Notice that also, as they've lost financial muscle, the big American newspapers have been very successfully cowed by corporate interests, by people trying to police their behavior, particularly on the right, and by politicians. I pointed out in my column in nationalmemo.com, Aaron Sorkin's The Newsroom skewers stenography posing as journalism and how people who fight back against it, the system doesn't support them every Sunday night. I mean, it's very important, I think, that every journalist watch that show because it's an indictment of what's gone wrong. And I think you'll see Bezos try to figure out ways to make the model work based on the Internet, not on the legacy of print.
And that's obviously not where the future is, but that's where the present is. He did pledge not to change much, but that's what new owners say.
New owners always do. You know, Rupert Murdoch told the family that he bought the Wall Street Journal from that he wasn't going to change it, and as soon as he got in there, he began changing. And anybody who reads the journal carefully, as I've done for more than 40 years, can see that it's going from being an absolutely straight arrow, incredibly thoroughly and well-reported journal of what's going on in the business world to an increasingly right-wing political newspaper that has a lot of business news in it. And I'm sure that over time, Bezos will change the paper. And I hope, and I wrote this in my national memo column, that when he does begin making changes, the first thing he does is get rid of Fred Hyatt, who presides over an editorial page totally at a distance from its community. It is pro-war. It's anti-leaks, unless they're, of course, the official leaks of the kind the Post depends on. It's almost all white. It's almost all male. And it has an incredible odor of white skin privilege.
And that is, of course, an area where a new owner could legitimately have some impact.
You own the paper. The editorial page is yours. Now, on the news side, he's not going to be able to, even if he wants to, go in and tell people what to do. Newsrooms do not work like that. The only newsroom that I know of anywhere where you get directions on what to do is Fox News, or as I like to call it, faux news. We know this because memos have leaked out, people have left, and then all you have to do is watch it and notice that the same talking point, often false talking point, is perpetuated again and again and again.
Some critics have watched all this and said there's something a little sad about hoping for a better kind of billionaire to run these kinds of things. But is there a viable alternative to that, at least when it comes to the big papers like the Washington Post or the New York Times?
I don't think so. There may have been at one time, but remember, we are, as a country, have made policy decisions and continue to elect politicians who are making us poorer. It is the unstated, but in my books, Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal in the Fine Print, I've documented and elsewhere, that our policies are going to make us overall poorer. We're at the point now where the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans, that's about 272 million of us, have fallen back to the level of 1966 when Lyndon Baines Johnson was in the White House. While the incomes of the top 1% of the top 1%, a group in which Mitt Romney is near the bottom, he is a piker within that group, their income has grown in real terms $18 million a year per household. This massive redistribution scheme to benefit the globalized rich at the expense of everyone else is the big story that is not being covered at all, or when it is, not with any recognition of the big facts. Well, if you had gone to the staff of the LA Times or the New York Times when they were very well paid relative to the society, gee, it's possible they could have raised the money to buy the paper and run it as a collective. And on the Internet, you don't need the big capital expenditures that you do today. But that's not here now. It's not going to happen now. So we're going to end up with a bunch of billionaire owners. They won't have the same interest. And our hope has to be that this will result in competition among them, because what's really gone wrong is two things. It's not the lack of investigative reporting. I'm the president of investigative reporters and editors. There's lots of great investigative reporting going on in this country, locally, regionally, and nationally. What we're losing is beat reporting, where reporters have a deep knowledge of the issues and the subjects they're covering. Nobody covers the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. You get how much money you spend for electricity every month and for natural gas and for gas for your car is in good part determined by the policies of that agency. Nobody covers it. I wrote chapters about it in my latest book. Maybe nobody wants to read about it either. But if the Koch brothers on the LA Times and Mayor Bloomberg gets his hand on the New York Times, as I suggested in my national memo column is likely, and the Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, maybe we'll get competition for readers that will get us better news than we're getting right now.
We've been speaking with veteran journalist David K. Johnston. His column about the sale of the Washington Post can be read at nationalmemo.com. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin, David K. Johnston.
Thank you, Peter.
August 5th was the one-year anniversary of the biggest act of violence against a U.S. religious community since the 1963 Alabama church bombings. But many Americans would be hard-pressed to recall the massacre at Oak Creek, Wisconsin, where a white supremacist opened fire at a Sikh house of worship, or gurdwara, killing Sikhs and injuring many more. Domestic terrorism perpetrated by white supremacists doesn't seem to grab the media's attention like some other acts of violence. So you wouldn't expect the volume of media commemorations, which will likely occur on the anniversaries of the Boston Marathon bombing or the Newtown school shooting. That doesn't mean that much isn't happening in Oak Creek. We're joined by journalist Jay Zalnor, who traveled to Wisconsin to report for The Real News on the one-year anniversary of the massacre. Jay Zalnor, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you reported on Oak Creek a year ago, and you were back reporting on it for the one-year commemoration. Tell us about all that.
Yeah, sure. And I'd also like to say that I'm also from the Sikh religion. I'm not religious particularly, but, you know, I grew up with a turban and a beard. I no longer keep my hair, but that's one of the main tenets of the faith. So I do have the experience of growing up in this country as an immigrant. That's also one of the reasons I decided to become a journalist as well, because I had many very eye-opening experiences during my childhood growing up. And I'd been reporting on the Sikh community, you know, before the Oak Creek Massacre. And so when this happened, you know, I knew it'd be important to, you know, have a progressive and independent perspective on what was happening. There's not many journalists of Sikh faith out there today. So, you know, I wanted to make sure that my own community story got told. On the morning of Sunday, August 5th, 2012, Wade Michael Page, a known white supremacist with links to neo-Nazis, he entered the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, and he opened fire, as you mentioned, killing several worshipers there. And I think it's important to note that Sikh temples around the world are always open. It's a place where anyone can go for a meal and to get food. And also, Sundays are the day where particularly where it's open, where they have meals and large gatherings. So it seems like this was a calculated attack. So as a journalist and a Sikh, I wanted to make sure that our story was told and that the story was told with some context. Because especially after 9/11, but even before, Sikhs have been targeted. And a large reason for that comes because they have turbans and beards. And by design, they stand out in the crowd. So I wanted to also tell the story of how this violence against Sikhs was and has been ongoing. And even after Oak Creek, there's been several incidents where Sikhs have been targeted and singled out and attacked in this country. Being there, I think, was a real honor for me. I have never felt so proud to be of this religion, of this community. The entire community responded in a tremendous fashion. There was an overwhelming sense of healing and love. And for me, that was personally moving. Many Sikh communities, including the one in Oak Creek, traditionally, they kind of stick to themselves because they do stand out. They don't want to draw a lot of unnecessary attention, which can often be negative. But in the last year, the community has redoubled its efforts to go out and educate the local community there. They received an outpouring of support from all over the U.S. and all over the world. And especially the young people have reached out. They're working in schools. You know, they're working with other community organizations. And, you know, making a lot of connections with the LGBT community, African-American community there, the Latino community there, other immigrant groups there. So being there, I would have imagined that the national media would have seized on this as a great story of perseverance, of immigrants coming to this country, being discriminated against, but overcoming against all odds. Yet instead, you know, this does not fit into this dominant narrative. So those stories were excluded. So I thought that was an absolute disservice that the media did. And I have to say, even the progressive media, I think, did not and has not told these stories as much as they should.
Well, in your Real News reporting, there's a Sikh attorney representing SALDEF, the Sikh civil rights group, who I think speaks for Sikh communities in general when he suggested that their tragedy and their ongoing struggles don't receive the attention that they should. We've certainly found that domestic terrorism by Muslims and violence that targets largely white Americans, as many of the school shootings have, just get a lot more attention than other sorts of violence and massacres. An ineffective bomb planted by a disaffected Muslim that fizzles in Times Square gets 14 times as much coverage as a professionally made bomb planted by a white supremacist at a Martin Luther King Day parade in Spokane. You spoke about the dominant narrative. Somehow, the media seem more comfortable with the Muslim terrorism framing. I wonder if you, as a reporter, could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point because, you know, I spoke about how the Sikh community has done, you know, essentially all they can to do outreach and to educate the country and especially in Oak Creek about their religion and their, you know, why they have turbans, why they have beards. The underlying thing they are trying to challenge, you know, every stereotype you see in the media, in Hollywood, anywhere you look in our culture, you associate brown immigrant men with turbans and beards as terrorists. So that is the dominant narrative. You know, the Sikh community is doing all they can to counter this narrative. The son of the temple president who was killed, he even befriended a former white supremacist who blames himself for possibly being an inspirational figure to Wade Michael Page, the man that carried out this attack. Mm-hmm. So the Sikh community is doing everything they can, but the media itself, it needs to really look at how they portray people that look Middle Eastern, and they need to have some positive role models. They've missed this opportunity to start addressing their problem with their coverage.
And it's not just about Sikhs standing up and saying, hey, we're not Muslims. They're taking on the bigger issue of discrimination in general against immigrants of a certain type or ethnicities of a certain type.
Yeah, absolutely. I think their challenge is to humanize themselves in the eyes of the average American. Their only time most Americans have seen a man with a turban is on, you know, NBC or Fox News or CNN when they're looking at, you know, Taliban figures or bin Laden. And the reality is that there's a whole religion that wears turbans. And the vast majority of Muslims who wear turbans or have beards have nothing to do with terrorism. And so, you know, that you're exactly right. Like, this stereotype, this narrative that's being told in the mainstream media, it's wrong. And it's dangerous, and, you know, it can definitely lead to violence. The Sikh community has come a long way in doing what they can, but where has our society come over this last year? And unfortunately, overall, many Sikh advocates and myself feel that, you know, we haven't come to a point where this event would be any less likely today to repeat itself. So we're in the same exact position we were a year ago, and unfortunately, this could happen again.
So what we need is a media that, rather than demonizing certain groups, humanizes them. I mean, that really is the key to acceptance and the key to understanding, is once journalists get down to looking at communities, they humanize them. And in every case, there are many things to like and to love about various communities. We've been speaking with Jocelyn Noor. He's been reporting on the massacre at Oak Creek, Wisconsin, at the Sikh temple. You can see his reporting on therealnews.com. Jocelyn Noor, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me, and really appreciate the opportunity.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. Go to FAIR.org for more information. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.